Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, and we'll continue our explorations of the cultures of consciousness. Today is a very special day for those of you who isn't sensitive to apocalyptic memes. Although it's odd because you won't be hearing this until after December 21st, 2012, but this conversation is being recorded before, in fact, the day before, the purported end of the world and the certain end of one complicated cycle of the complicated Mayan calendar. So it's with great appropriateness that today we are talking with none other than Dennis McKenna, who, along with his brother Terrence, the well-known psychedelic bard, helped concoct some of the ideas and notions, a little bit more on Terrence's side than Dennis's, that fed these rather impressive meme, which some person on the radio this morning was describing as sort of the first internet-based apocalyptic scenario. I think there's probably other things we could mention as well, but his idea being that it was an idea that was spread, fomented, refashioned, reframed largely in the information space, so from the bottom up, so to speak, rather than the top down from crazy charismatic religious leaders, although as a certain kind of charismatic figure, Terrence did have his role to play in the current meme, which is quite a big deal. Apparently, someone said that, some 20% of Chinese people think the end of the world is upon us. And I know that in Russia, there are areas where there's massive food hoarding. And so these things are really global, and they're really quite alive. So it's with great pleasure that we'll be talking with Dennis today. But before that, we'll bring on our co-host here at Expanding Mind, Maja Dau. Hi, Maja.
Hi, Eric. How's it going?
Pretty good. Are you in any way slightly kind of, not concerned, but is there some sense that there might be some explicit thing that happens tomorrow that you kind of feel on some level, or are you just like, it's really just going to be kind of like a day like any other?
Well, it's funny because, in a lot of my line of work, I will give prophecies to people.
Because you're doing astrology readings, you're doing I Ching readings, right?
Totally, and I'm always very aware of the responsibility for what you say because of human beings' propensity for self-fulfilling prophecy. So whenever there's these apocalyptic memes that hit on such a global level, to me it's interesting because I'll think of it like, well, even if there wasn't anything that's going to happen, now because everyone's got these ants in their pants, we'll probably make something happen, right? So to me it's not so much that I feel this giant universal shift, although I do feel like there's definitely been a lot of energy moving. I mean, look at all the revolutions breaking out everywhere. Like, it's just ridiculous how much it's kind of building momentum. But having said that, I feel like if there is anything that happens tomorrow, it'll be along the lines of people making it happen and pushing it in that direction.
Absolutely. Yeah, that totally makes sense, the self-fulfilling prophecy. It's like, that's almost what culture is.
Yeah.
One big self-fulfilling prophecy. Well, with that, let's bring on Dennis McKenna. Dennis, thanks for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Well, thanks, Eric. I'm happy to be here on the day before the singularity. And Marja, is it?
Yeah, Marja. Mm-hmm.
I'm happy to make your acquaintance on the phone. Yeah, it's great to be here.
Well, I just want to say, I didn't mention it at the opening, that one of the reasons we're talking with you right now is not just the appropriateness of the date, but because your book on Terrence and your life together, The Brotherhood of the Screaming Abyss, came out, I guess, about a month ago.
Uh-huh.
It's a great book. I wanted to just let people know that it's a fascinating read if you're at all interested in Terrence or the history of the counterculture or crazy psychedelic ideas or, you know, just a wonderful slice of odd American life, definitely track down Dennis's book, which just, it's also one of the interesting things about your book also was how you got the funding to write it. I mean, you had a Kickstarter, you decided to go with Kickstarter to raise money for it.
That's right.
And you did very well.
Yeah, we did. Actually, it was Dan Levy, it was Terrence's old editor, that put me up to that, because I went to New York in 2010 on some other business, but I had been thinking about writing this memoir, and I had lunch with Dan, and I actually wondered, you know, if he might know a literary agent or some publisher that might be interested, and he said, well, you know, there's this new thing going on called Kickstarter. You ought to look into it. And the rest is history, you know. I did look into it, and he led me down the primrose path. And there are both good things and bad things about doing it that way. But we raised more money for a publishing project than had ever been raised at that time on Kickstarter. So that was surprising and gratifying, you know, that we were able to do that. On the other hand, I'm such a poor budget planner and all that, that even though we raised almost $90,000, actually about, yeah, a little more than that, because there were some other channels through which people contributed, but even though we raised that much money, it's still costing me a fortune. You know, the Kickstarter money is long gone, and now I have to send 850 or so supporters. I have to send copies of books, and some of them are in foreign countries, and it's, you know, it's a big hit every time you send a book by priority mail. But I made the promise, and I'm going to keep the promise if it kills me, and it may well, you know. I mean, it's pretty stressful right now.
Well, one of the things about that is it just shows how interested people were in hearing your story. And just for people who don't you know, maybe they know a little bit about Terrence, is that, you know, I mean, not only were you brothers and close friends, if rivals at times, and like all brothers had this very you know, tempestuous relationship, which is part of what makes the book so fascinating, is that you were also sort of, you know, there at many of the key moments in Terrence's earlier life, where he was having the experiences and building the concepts and building the ideas that later in the 80s and 90s, when he became a kind of talking head and a roving, you know, stand-up shaman, that he was sort of riffing off of. But a lot of the core points of your experiences together in Berkeley, and of course with the great experiment in La Trera, that you were there. So we get this sort of other side of a story that we may be familiar with from Terrence's side, and it's a really wonderful opportunity. But in terms of, like, what was it that you wanted to sort of do by telling your side of the story? I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of answers to that, but what was really driving you to the, even if somewhat well supported, but the you know, the hard work of writing, and is particularly writing about one's own life and interviewing, and that's it's a big chore.
Yeah,
you wanted to bring?
Well, multiple motivations. You know, I mean, for one thing, I've never really explicitly gone out and told my own story. You know, we've told our story. Terrence has told his version of our story, especially in True Hallucinations, you know, and The Invisible Landscape, which was much earlier, was not really a storytelling, but a collaboration on the trying to, you know, an exposition of our ideas that we cooked up to try to present to the wider world, and in some ways, I think, to justify to ourselves, you know, a lot of these crazy notions. We tried to integrate those into a quasi-scientific rational framework. So our task in writing The Invisible Landscape was to try to make sense out of a bunch of ideas and notions that really were very hard to make sense out of. But it was a credible effort, and it obviously got people's attention. But I just felt like I wanted to tell my side of the story, and 2012 seemed like the year to do it, right? Because of the significance of that date in our own mythology and personal history, that was one reason. Opportunity presented itself to do it this year. I now understand the book is not even going to get out to a lot of supporters before the year ends because of logistical problems, but I just felt that this was a good time to do it, and I had wanted to tell the story for a long time, and so I seized the, not least of all because I'm not getting any younger, and memory is a funny thing, memory has a way of evaporating and also recreating itself. So I thought, before I become completely demented, maybe I better get this down.
Well, I was thinking about how lucky your daughter is, because the Mormons have this sort of practice that it's widely practiced, where you keep a record of your life, like mm-hmm. a journal, but you do it for your descendants. It's not just like a private record. It's almost like a story of your life that will pass on to them, because the Mormons have this idea that the families stay together in the afterlife. So it's like mm-hmm. really important to know what great Uncle Ned was up to, because you're going to meet him someday, and you want to be able to say, hey, how's the fishing up here, or whatever. And
right.
I'm just reading through the story going, like, my God, if I had, a quarter of this information from my parents, albeit they lived slightly less dramatic lives.
Right,
but,
right.
But it's just it's a great excursion in memory, and there's, things about your own experience that I'd love to talk about, but just because of the day, and I want to make sure that we get to this, I want to zoom in a little on these ideas of the time wave of the sort of guy in mind, these concepts that came up out of your and Terrence's attempt to wrestle with these profound psychedelic experiences that were completely peculiar,
uh-huh.
within which you were sort of not even exactly there. At least in a conventional sense. And now you're here sort of writing from a more skeptical perspective than your brother had in many ways about these experiences in which you were really the sort of conduit of this apparently oracular galactic power. So it's a very complicated and interesting situation. So I would just love to have a little bit of a riff on how... how these ideas came to be, how you felt about them then versus how you feel about them now, and especially what kind of corrective you felt like you wanted to offer in addition to sort of Terrence's view.
Well, that covers a lot of territory. I think, for... leading up to La Chirera and sort of the formulation of the ideas that led us to attempt this experiment at La Chirera, which I think you have to put that in quote, because it was at La Chirera, but it certainly wasn't an experiment in any conventional sense. But we were, the thing about Terrence and I was most of what happened to us and what made us interesting to the rest of the world happened when we were nobody, before anybody knew our names or there was any myth or mythos around us. That was all post La Chirera, and really I think Terrence had most to do with that, because he was much more public about it. So, but before all that, we were just a couple of curious and peculiar people, who also had a lot of interesting friends who also had funny ideas, one of whom I talk about in the book at some extent, John Parker, who was a high school friend of Terrence's, but became a very good friend of mine and a mentor. And in some ways, he deserves a lot of the credit for, if not necessarily the original ideas, but for kind of seeding the ground, fertile ground in which these ideas could take root. And there were various influences, you know, back, as I say, in the 60s, before anybody knew us, we were just, you know, kind of egghead-ish, nerdish, hippies, but we weren't hippies. We didn't really identify with that, but we were very interested in psychedelics, and we were especially interested in DMT. That to us seemed the ultimate psychedelic in some ways, and worth pursuing. It wasn't just that it was an interesting drug; it was simply the most interesting, you know, phenomenon, thing in our sphere. And when that came to our attention, it was essentially, it was like finding an incomprehensible object or something that you couldn't really not be fascinated with. Although I guess many people encountered it and said, well, that's interesting, and, you know, went back to whatever they were doing. We couldn't do that. We felt that, you know, it had some significance beyond just itself, and we determined to go after it for whatever reason. We could not do that. So, you know, it was that. It was our, you know, our fascination really coming out of a background of science fiction, Jungian psychology, alchemy, shamanism, and all that. You know, and not necessarily a comprehensive grasp of those things, but certainly those affected our interests. So we were motivated to plunge into it. When DMT surfaced on our radar, it was like, this is worth looking into, you know. And so the question became, how do we look into it? How do we proceed? And initially, we thought, well, you know, one thing that seemed obvious was that the effect of the acute effect of smoking DMT is so short that all you really can do is come away with a sense of astonishment and a feeling that something incredible has just happened. But beyond that, it's very hard to bring much back from that. So we thought, well, you know, maybe if we could spend longer in this DMT state, maybe we could kind of get our sea legs, maybe we could kind of learn to navigate and get more noetic content out of it, if you will, because it seemed to be loaded with that. But in the afterglow of the experience, there is a tendency to try to put it into a linguistic box. I mean, you're barely down before you start trying to explain it to yourself, and you realize that that's futile, that, you know, no linguistic model can really get it. So we were motivated to find a different form of DMT, an orally active form, which we thought might be might be able to spend a longer time in. And that was really what motivated us to go to South America, was looking for this obscure Witoto drug called Ukuhei, which emerged. It was a DMT-based preparation used by the Witoto people. And we thought, aha, that we ought to go check that out, you know. And that's what led us to go to La Chirera originally, because that's the ancestral home of the Witoto people, and that's how we ended up going there. When we got there, it turned out that Ukuhei, this obscure indigenous drug, was really a red herring. It was, you know, because La Chirera was a mission village in southeastern Colombia that had been cleared. It was a Capuchin mission village, and the pasture around the area, the forest had been cut down around the mission, and cattle had been brought in there, And along with the cattle had come Psilocybe cubensis, which were just abundant in this area, at least that season when we got there. And so we thought, well, we didn't really know. This is how naive we were. We thought Ukuhe is the real mystery. Here are these mushrooms growing all around us. We sort of said, well, this will be nice recreational distraction while we're looking for the real mystery. Well, of course, the mushrooms are the real mystery, and the mushrooms are the perfect orally active form of DMT. It's very, very close to DMT, and it's essentially tailored for human metabolism. Ukuhe, when we finally did get it, was proved, a curiosity, proved interesting, but nothing really to write home about in a certain sense. Although I did half my PhD about it 10 years later, but that's another story. So when we got to La Chorrera, and in complete innocence, really, and naivete, we started eating these mushrooms for entertainment and to pass the time while we were hanging out, and it quickly became more than entertainment. And the mushroom lost the mushroom I represent as an almost a guest at the table. The elf who came to dinner, I don't know, but it was either the mushroom or whatever intelligence was speaking through the mushroom, quickly started, downloading a whole lot of very odd ideas to us to me especially, about things we could do, about an experiment that we could perform. And that became the experiment at La Chorrera.
Well, in that way, it reminds me of something in occult lore, which is that sometimes the spirits that are contacted, in fact, often, not just in the occult, but I think in more traditional practices, where I think Maja probably has something to say about this, is just that sometimes the spirits will tell you how to create the practice that will manifest them better. I mean, you see this with John Dee. It's like the angels say, hey, here's the way to do this. You got to make a board. Yeah, it's really complicated. So it's got all these letters on it. They're actually not normal letters. Here's what they look like. And there's this whole elaborate procedure that itself is communicated. It's like the dimension wants.
And that was exactly, was exactly it. It was a series of instructions. It was like, if you do these things, if you sing to the mushroom, if you imitate this sound that you can hear inside your head on high doses of mushrooms, you can affect this superconducting bond through the fourth dimension with the DNA of the mushroom, and you can essentially create an artifact. It was what it was saying. Here's the blueprint. This is what you have to do.
No, they do. Like, they'll literally give you blueprints for not just, like, that kind of stuff, but even for physical things. Like, you look at Tesla, how he received his alternating current motor, or, like, how the periodic table was. They do. It's, like, literally mechanistic,
Yeah, and I think Tesla probably was tapping into much the same kind of territory, except he was, an engineer and a tinkerer and a person who could, build these machines. We were none of that. We were, if anything, if we had any credentials, we were botanists and so on. But it was about, yes, here's how you build an artifact made out of plants and mushrooms and your own mind and sound and light, and this will be a physical object or a biophysical object with certain properties, and mainly that it can do anything you could imagine, and it will be made of a fusion of mind and matter. Well, if you look into history for analogs to that, that the philosopher's stone, or comes up as the sort of historical analog, and in more modern times, the UFO, the time machine, all of these things, I think, are metaphors for the same thing, something that is material but not totally material, that's partly made out of information and partly made out of, you know, biological material, and and it's something that you create out of your own body. And if you look back at, if you look into shamanic traditions, this is, I mean, it sounds crazy, but if you look into some of these traditions, you find similarities to this. The substance called phlegm in the ayahuasca tradition is much the same thing. It's a physical substance. It's not ordinary phlegm like you produce in your lungs. Well, you do, but you express it out of your body. And it has properties that make it seem like a fourth-dimensional fluid. And
like ectoplasm.
What's that?
Like ectoplasm.
Like ectoplasm, yeah, exactly. Like ectoplasm. We called it translinguistic matter. We called it something that was both matter and meaning. It was the logos itself, but the logos exteriorized. And, you know, to discuss this now in the sober light of not being intoxicated on mushrooms and from 30, 40 years on, it just seems, you know, these are pretty mind-stretching ideas. And some people would say, well, they're just ridiculous. This is gibberish. But at the time, you know, the mushroom was very matter of fact about all this. It was like, you know, never mind that you don't understand this, just do it. And we did. And we downloaded, we channeled what it said, and there was a whole bunch of stuff about electron spin resonance and, you know, intercalating, you know, the molecules into DNA and setting up a standing waveform that would, you know, that rendered, that DNA would be rendered superconductive and set up a standing waveform. We didn't know anything about any of this stuff. I mean, we had the, you know, we had the science fiction enthusiasts' perspective on this, but we were certainly not biophysicists.
Well, I mean, that's one of the wonderful things about your book, and quite unique, is that you, because you're also a real scientist, and because you are also temperamentally, you know, a pretty down-to-earth guy, you're not mm-hmm. you're not ready to jump on the latest, you know, wacky notion or you know, give in to the romantic dream of possibility compared to the sort of, you know, continued reassertion of ordinary reality. So you're a pretty down-to-earth guy. You went through these spaces. You don't, in your account of it, you don't deny them their own validity in their own world. You give them room. You even create certain openings, certain possibilities. There's certain science fiction moments of your own reflections, mm-hmm. even in the current moment, as you sit back and look at this stuff and you go, well, most of it's kind of hooey, and in uh-huh. fact, I know how science really works, and this is not true. This wasn't an experiment. You're not making any of the usual pseudoscientific moves that people who walk this borderline between science and imagination often do, generally do, almost always do, inside psychedelics, inside uh-huh. the New Age. You're not doing that, and yet, you're not just going, look, it's all, we were just kids who was crazy, don't even try, it's not even worth, you know, it's not even worth going there. You're not doing that either.
No, I'm not doing that. I think it's too simplistic, too easy to dismiss this as a simultaneous psychosis, you know, which is the totally, you know, down-to-earth and maybe rational way to look at it. But that would not give it its due. You know, there were things going on that had nothing to do with our simultaneous psychosis, which certainly that was part of the dynamic. But just certain episodes can't be so glibly explained away. You know, the episode with the key, for example, the instances of telepathy, you know, which were objectively verifiable, that the certain aspects of you know, of the experience that were a lot like time travel. I mean, just things that are hard to explain away, you know. And even at the time when we were going through this, we were cognizant of the similarities with psychosis, and in fact we even said to each other, schizophrenia is what happens to people who get lost in hyperspace, you know, and that may not be so far off the mark in a certain way. And you know, and then there were things that came to light later that we couldn't, you know, we accepted as you know, as truth handed down from this source that was just making these pronouncements. But then later there was verification, you know, yes, these compounds can intercalate into DNA quite readily. And you know, DNA can be superconductive under certain conditions, and whether all of that, you know, gives insights into how these things work on the biological level is not clear. But at least we know these things take place, and so there was, you know, like one of the members of the Brotherhood who I had dinner with recently, you know, we were discussing it. One of the few I'm still in touch with, who I guess I won't mention here because she actually has a respectable job, but you know, we were having dinner, and I said, well, what is your perspective? Do you think it was just psychosis, or was there anything spooky going on? She said, and even she admitted that she couldn't, you know, couldn't really say, and I don't think we can. One of the conclusions that I've come to terms with, made a certain peace with, is that, you know, simply looking at ordinary reality and our existential situation and the fact that, you know, we're these hypertrophied, you know, these curious monkeys with these hypertrophied brains in this anthropic universe, I mean, the whole thing is just totally unlikely, you know, and so we can hew to a scientific, rationalist, materialistic perspective, but we should be cautious in assuming that that explains very much. Because if you just look at your own existential situation or the existential situation of our species, you have to think there's a lot more going on. You know, how did we get to this place?
I mean, for me, it doesn't seem like
random events would bring us to this place.
Exactly. And it's almost like how there's always mystery in one's experience and one's models of reality and reality itself. And it's almost like a philosophical attitude. The rationalist is like, behind every mystery is a problem that can be solved. Behind the romantic is that it's all mystery. And then there's this sort of middle path where you're like, well, actually, behind the mystery are problems to be solved, but you're really just pushing the mystery farther into the world, farther into yourself. There's no escaping it, and so there's a certain humility that comes from that. But uh-huh. A lot of these arguments about, you know, science and mystical experience and things like kind of follow along that borderline. But having said that, we must take a break here on The Expanding Mind. You're listening to myself and Maja Daoud talking to Dennis McKenna, and we'll be right back after this.
Okay.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maja Daoud here talking with Eric Davis and Dennis McKenna today. What a treat. Dennis, you mentioned something that really kind of stuck in my mind that I wanted to extrapolate on a little bit, especially in terms of 2012 and what's going on right now. You mentioned when you and Terrence were first kind of smoking DMT, how it wasn't enough time, how it was too short. And correct me if I'm wrong, but part of what sparked your journey was trying to find something where you could go be in the space longer. And this is an interesting thing to me, because it's like, okay, here we are, these crazy monkeys with these weird brains that have some weird capacity to open that space for that experience of some kind of crazy consciousness, right? We know we can get like this little blip, like a little glimpse, like, oh my God, what was that? And then it's like, oh, okay, now we're back in our regular deal. So a lot of people with the 2012 idea are saying it's going to be a consciousness shift, and that we're kind of heading towards this place where maybe our brains will get to like evolve to some place where we'll all kind of get to be in a consciousness that'll be a little bit more akin to maybe like what we get these little, you know, shifty slideshows of whenever we alter our consciousness. And I wanted to ask you, I mean, like you said, like schizophrenics could possibly be people who just get stuck there, like if they are in that place for way too long. Even though a lot of people try to get in those spots for longer, we can also see, you know, like you said, the repercussions of what happens to your mind when you just kind of get in there for a little too long. So how do you feel, in your opinion, like in all the things you and your brother went through, do you think that's kind of like what we're leading up to that ability to have our minds just be in that blown out state all the time? I mean, what do you think about that?
Well, no, I can't really imagine that. I mean, I don't think we would be very functional, if we were in that state all the time. It would be hard to get very much done, but part of the skill of the shaman is the ability to navigate in these areas and keep one foot in the non-ordinary realm and one foot, on the ground, so to speak. So I think it's a learned skill, but I also think that, you know, with the technologies that we're developing, I mean, it may be that drugs like DMT are a temporary phase where, you know, people are now, they have had enough exposure to these non-ordinary states, and look, they can treat them as models almost of altered states, and people are now approaching this through cybernetics, through computer simulations, virtual reality, and all of that. So I think that it's not so much, I think that maybe this is in some ways a preparation for that, or, you know, part of that evolution. We may reach a point within the next, you know, 10 years perhaps, where virtual reality technology really does come online and is much more sophisticated than it is now. And we may reach a point where we're kind of half in and half out of virtual reality all the time. I mean, you can see this developing. We spend so much time now staring at screens and, you know, interacting that way. And so maybe, McLuhan said, one of our favorite, you know, mentors back in the 60s and 70s, he said, psychedelic drugs are models for electric culture. So in some ways, they're learning tools so that when this does come and we're completely connected, we'll be able to handle that. We are in a kind of a more or less altered state now all the time because, you know, information is so pervasive, and we live in this information space as much as we do in physical space. And, you know, with the trends being what they are, I mean, people are talking about uploading consciousness into virtual space. I think we're a ways away from that, but maybe not as far as we think.
Well, let me ask you another question, kind of staying on some of these. You know, we've largely been talking in terms of the kind of a more reasonable way of trying to address some of these questions, and a kind of skepticism about building up, you know, elaborate sort of quasi-scientific explanations for what's going on, and a sort of, you know, humility in relationship to our ability to extract information from these altered states. And again, that sense of kind of the balance of disenchantment and romanticism is something that you're working out throughout the book in a really interesting way that you need to read to really appreciate. But one thing I would ask you, because I know you've continued to have your you know, a deep relationship with ayahuasca, and it's been it's an important part of your life, even as you have been someone who made their living in the, you know, being a working scientist, not as being an underground guru or some kind of hipster freak. You know, you've just been working in the world. Mm-hmm. And what after all this time and reflecting on your own experience, reflecting on your relationship with ayahuasca, would you still hold out as kind of the romantic hope that psychedelics offers you, or maybe offers us, in the midst of obviously a very, you know, some serious real world difficulties? And you know, after going through this process of disenchantment, what's kind of crystallized for you as the sort of that almost the element of kind of faith or inspiration that comes through these experiences?
Well, yeah, several things, actually. I mean, I think your mention of humility is right on the money, because if these psychedelics and, you know, if DMT and ayahuasca and my whole experience in these areas has taught anything, it's that we know very little, and I certainly know very little, you know, and so there's no reason for arrogance, because most of the picture is not apparent to anyone. And, you know, I mean, so there's no reason to assume that we have it figured out. We don't. I don't think anybody does. I think anybody that tells you they have it figured out, that's a red flag to run the other way. We're all immersed in this, and we're all trying to, you know, puzzle it out. So, and that's good, you know, to admit that you don't know a lot of things. Where we don't know very much means that there's lots more to learn, and that's not a depressing prospect for me. That's a very exciting prospect. You know, that most discoveries have yet to be made. A comprehensive picture of the world and you know, our place in it has not yet formed, and that's what we're in the process of trying to put together. So that's one of the main lessons I think that ayahuasca has taught me, and it sounds kind of trivial to say it, but every time it's like, remember, you know, the limitations of your knowledge, and especially the limitations of science. I think that most scientists could benefit from a stiff dose of ayahuasca or one of these substances, because it's a reminder of, you know, how little really. I mean, science understands certain aspects of reality very, very well and in great detail. They're not so good at putting those things together into the big picture. And, you know, scientists can be, they you know, I think an occupational hazard of doing science is a certain arrogance that we know more than we do. Science now is a big money, you know, an institutionalized kind of activity. And I think a lot of scientists really lose sight of what they're trying to do. Ultimately, science should be a search for truth. You know, it's a powerful way to ask questions of nature and get answers back that you can test or more or less verify. But that it's easy to lose sight of that in the, you know, in the day-to-day activity of getting grants and having graduate students and carrying out experiments and publishing papers and all that. My own personal view is that all scientists should be forced to take courses in philosophy of science forced to think about what it is that they're really doing here and what they're
doing. There's such tremendous evidence of that. I mean, just look at, like, the Higgs boson particle, for example. I mean, the scientist is looking at a phenomenon in nature, and what does he do? He puts his name on it. He puts his name on it.
Right.
You know, and just that, to me, just that very thing is evidence of the lack of humility that you're discussing, is how these people will think they can see something in nature and then own it like it's theirs, and they're the ones that have figured it out. And mm-hmm. like you said, like the ayahuasca is trying to break us out of that mentality to see, like, hey, guess what? This is not about
right.
you.
You monkeys you don't know so much. You don't know as much as you think you do, and that's the message. And I think the other message for me personally about ayahuasca and for other, a lot of other people too, I think that really there is something to this Gaian mind idea. And I think ayahuasca, you know, comes to us kind of as an ambassador from the community of species, if you will, and has an urgent message for us, which is basically wake up. You know, you're problematic. You, the monkeys, are problematic to the stability of the whole system, and you need to wake up and smell the coffee or whatever before it's too late. And many, many people are coming to that conclusion as a result of profound psychedelic experiences that lead them to ponder our current planetary, environmental, historical crisis and our place in nature. I think that's a big part of the message that ayahuasca brings, and other psychedelics as well. I don't dismiss those, but it seems that ayahuasca now is more the carrier of the meme, possibly because it emerges out of the Amazon, one of the more impacted places on the planet. And I don't know if you know, I've published an essay some years ago which has appeared various places. It's called Ayahuasca and Human Destiny. And it's around on the net, and it was actually published in the Journal of Psychoactive Drugs, I think in 2004. And it's kind of a personal statement. I think that ayahuasca exemplifies the coevolutionary relationships that we've always had with these plants. So you have to look at the current historical context of ayahuasca, the emergence of ayahuasca onto the global stage, really, out of these indigenous cultures. This is an aspect of the further coevolutionary unfolding of our relationship, which has been going on for, who knows, 50,000, 100,000 years in the case of some of these plants. And I think, you know, I think that ayahuasca has great promise in the sense that, you know, people feel that if you know, they're teaching tools, they're educational tools, and if you can get that experience to the right people who are in a position to make a difference, it will help to turn things around. It will help to bring about this global shift in consciousness.
Yeah, one of the ways to think about it, you know, we've been talking before about the global shift and these sort of more nebulous ideas of what that could amount to. And the thing that's powerful about the psychedelics is that if that's possible, if something like that could actually happen, if that kind of shift in mind space might be noticeable, it's going to happen through practical, pragmatic techniques and technologies and situations. It's
right.
Not just going to happen through some, like, you know, resonating astral, you know, tone that is emitted and then suddenly everybody wakes up. It's going to happen through, you know, the work of culture and not just the
right.
ideas of
it,
culture.
But it will happen through changing hearts and minds, right?
Yeah.
And the hearts and minds of the people who are in powerful positions to change policies, I mean, is really what it comes down to. And if you can use ayahuasca to lead those people to a sort of a profound re-understanding of our relationship to nature, then I think we have hope, right? That's what gives me hope, because suddenly, you know, there is, I guess, to a certain extent, there's an us-them dynamic going on here. So if you think of us as us, the psychedelic community or the community that is concerned with the preservation of the planet, these are powerful tools that have been put into our hands to change hearts and minds, and they really do, you know, if you can get them into the, you know, get the right people. I mean,
well, in a way, this gives you an interesting perspective also on, you know, one of the big questions that coming out of reading your book is about how to assess the legacy of Terrence. And you're wrestling with this throughout, because you kind of see the difficulties that he got put in, and the way he was put on a pedestal by some people, and the way that he, you know, found himself kind of just because he needed a job. And, you know, there's a lot of complicated things that you deal with very well, with a lot more nuance than we can have. You know, we have like 8 minutes left on the program. Mm-hmm. But it is interesting to think about it in terms of his ability to spread the word. I mean, one of the interesting things about DMT historically, in terms of cultural history, is that DMT was known in the 60s. Had hooked DMT. There was a discourse around it. There was in some places that was like the first thing that people would discover, because you could make it. You got your hands on the right papers, you could make it. Mm-hmm. But it didn't really enter into the sort of mythography of that moment. It didn't quite, it was almost too weird. It almost eluded the sort of net of LSD and Hare Krishna and Jimi Hendrix and this whole kind of cultural thing. And it really isn't until Terrence that it becomes kind of an opening. It becomes a resonator that actually works across culture. And I think that's really significant in terms of this symbiotic view, and specifically in terms of how your brother helped, you know, kind of create this culture. And again, we only have a couple of minutes left, and I know it's a big topic, but I've been on Twitter asking people about questions to ask you, and one of the questions that's come up is something that's touched on at the end of your book, but I think is a really important thing to bring up about Terrence, which is that there was a sort of misperception of him as being somebody who was like, take heroic doses of mushrooms every weekend, and, you know, that he was this wild and crazy guy. But he himself sort of had a very, very difficult experience, I think, towards the end of the 1980s, and ended up having a very complicated relationship in some ways to the kind of heavy psychedelic experience that he's associated with. And in a way, it's one of the more kind of poignant, but I think really substantial elements of his legacy, if you want to think about it, that he had his own very complex relationship to that. And this was just another question that came up on my Twitter feed, and I wanted to give you a little opportunity to reflect on that and Terrence's legacy as you see it now.
Well, yeah, he did have a complicated relationship, and I think anybody who doesn't have a complicated relationship with these substances is not paying attention, right? I mean, you have to, if you're going to get involved with these things, it's not simply the consumption, and it's not about a marathon of how high a dose do I take and how often. It's what do I do with the information that's downloaded to me? How does that change my life? How does that change the way I think about the world and relate to people? And Terrence, you know, faced that. I think anyone who works with these substances as a, you know, I mean, the term is overused, but as a spiritual practice or as a just a, I don't know what the term is, an intellectual practice, has got to ponder what all this means, if anything, and integrate it somehow. And that, you know, that's more important than how often you take them. And Terrence, I think that's a misperception that maybe he, to a certain extent, was guilty of, putting out the idea that he was some psychedelic cowboy. although in his own talks and so on, he often said, I am not an abuser. You know, I do this rarely, and yeah, I do heroic doses, but not every other week. And I think what he did with that information is exemplified by what he put out there, you know, this complex of ideas which have taken off, they've taken on a life of their own. He's achieved this strange internet immortality where his ideas resonate as strongly today as they ever did. And I think that's a good sign that he was onto something. He was doing something right. You know, what you said before about how in the 60s, DMT, it was around, people knew about it, but it never quite took off. And that's partly a function of what we were discussing earlier, how it's hard to bring anything back. It's so fast. All you have is this overwhelming sense of strangeness. Terrence was able to articulate that. He was able to bring more back and make it accessible to people.
Well, that's a wonderful place. We're going to have to wind up there. Dennis, thanks so much for being on Expanding Mind.
Okay, it was a great talk. Thanks, Eric, and thanks, Marja. We can do this again sometime, but I really enjoyed it. I think we covered most of the main bases, so
wonderful.
All right, so happy 2012 to you all.
Yeah.
We too.
Okay.
All right, so from all of us to all you, hope you hear us, or maybe not.
Well, we'll circle back from the other side. If you know, if we're in hyperspace, I'm sure we'll find each other somehow.
Bye.
Okay.